KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We had to stand up in front of a group of 1,000 people who had been working on this film, for some of them for over a year, and building these sets and building characters that now were not going to be applicable and had to be sort of sidelined and thrown away.
Production was well underway for the Disney animated movie Zootopia when directors Byron Howard and Rich Moore decided the film needed major changes. Breaking the news to animators was not easy, but the move paid off. Zootopia is now up for Best Animated Feature. Howard and Moore tell us how they made the transition from hand-drawn to computer animation and the real-world events that made them want to address topics like systemic bias in a kids' movie. But first on the news banter, Nick Cannon, who has been the host of NBC's America's Got Talent, has some interesting ideas about what that acronym, NBC, stands for. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So this week we had a blow-up with Nick Cannon, whose status as host of America's Got Talent is not quite clear. And it raises an interesting issue because what happened was he did a special on Showtime. He was like Nick Cannon unleashed. You know, Nick Cannon in America's Got Talent is one thing. And we're going to play a little sampling now of Nick Cannon on Showtime.
I'm going to use some different language than you used to seeing on America's Got Talent. You're going to hear a few sprinkled here throughout my show. Matter of fact, that's what NBC going to stand for tonight. Better come on. Because be cussing. So be careful.
So he then said on Facebook that it had been brought to his attention that NBC believed he was in breach of contract because he disparaged the brand. He was very upset about this. He said he found himself in a dark place, I'm quoting, as a man, as an artist, and a voice for my community, I will not be silenced, controlled, or treated like a piece of property. There is no amount of money worth my dignity or my integrity. So, you know, there are a couple of questions here, like, does a comedian actually damage a brand when they do something like this? And honestly, is it possible to say you represent NBC, therefore you can't do this on Showtime, which is owned by a CBS?
Right. And this brings up a number of interesting legal issues. First and foremost, you know, most talent, when they do a deal with a network, they have what's called a disparagement or a non-disparagement clause, where you are not allowed to disparage your employer in a public forum. That's one issue. This second issue is, does having a racy and, you know, off-color persona outside of a family show constitute a breach of contract, as he says NBC told him? So on the first issue, I don't know whether a comedian making a racially charged joke about NBC and the N-word constitutes a disparaging of the network.
It seems a stretch to me, I have to say.
It seems a bit of a stretch to me. I don't think NBC was damaged in any way by this. You know, people who watched a Nick Cannon Showtime special probably are not going to say, you know what,
I would have watched NBC.
but now I'm not going to. So I don't know about that. The second question is also interesting. You know, if Nick Cannon, in doing these off-color jokes and having a different persona, is somehow in breach of contract because his image is squeaky clean on America's Got Talent, all I have to say is Howard Stern. Howard Stern was a judge on America's Got Talent and has a completely off-color and racy persona outside of the show. So I don't know how this is any different from that. You know, Howard Stern probably isn't referring to NBC using the N-word, but who knows? I don't listen every second of Howard Stern. I don't know whether he's ever said that. You know, there's a long history of comedians who have a persona on television and have a much different persona when they are in their live act. I mean, Bob Saget is a perfect example. His Full House persona was very different from his stand-up. You know, Jay Leno, when he would do his stand-up gigs, was a little off-color, not so on The Tonight Show. I mean, Trevor Noah is touring, and I've seen his show. He does get a little bit off-color, not what he does on The Daily Show. So I don't really get that argument.
So, well, you know, it's a little unclear what the status of that is. I mean, probably you can make whatever joke you want as long as you don't use the acronym NBC, maybe. But honestly, a little sensitive there, it seems to me. Meanwhile, television generally. We have a report from our colleague, Leslie Goldberg, looking at big broadcast networks. And boy, a sharp dip in the number of pilots that these guys have been ordering. So this pilot season, this is ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, and the CW, collectively ordered 73 dramas and comedies. And that is down from 88 last year and 98 4 years ago. So that is a pretty precipitous drop.
I think it's a move in the right direction, first of all. I mean, it never made sense in this era of peak TV when shows are being produced year-round and, you know, so much of the TV landscape is dominated by reality and by returning shows. I mean, it never made sense to make 100 shows and then pick, you know, 12 or 14 to put on the air. But I think what it's really showing is that the networks are getting hip to the fact that they need to put all of their effort into making fewer shows that are better and have a better chance of getting picked up and being successful as series.
And I will say that if you like military dramas or family comedies, I don't know which of these, nobody knows which will for sure get picked up, but then you are in luck because that seems to be the preponderance of stuff that is being looked at this year. Quickly, I'm going to mention, you know, the nightmare of Fox News and the sexual harassment allegations against it is not over, against Roger Ailes. Of course, he's gone. But a lot of action in federal court this past week with a case brought by Andrea Tantros, a former Fox News on-air talent. Her attorney said in court that the Fox News is being investigated by the U.S. attorney in New York because the victims of Roger Ailes' alleged harassment, which apparently went on 4 years, were paid a lot of money, as he was, to go away. And the allegation is that you have to disclose payments of this nature and that Fox hid them and that this is a violation potentially of securities law.
Right. You know, you could make the argument that Fox News is part of a multiple billion-dollar-a-year company and that these payments are not, let's say, you know, material to the overall bottom line. But the real issue here is that this is not something that Fox News or the parent company wants to deal with for the next few years. I mean, they settled with Gretchen Carlson. They fired Roger Ailes and paid him more than $40 million to go away. They were hoping that this new case would be put into arbitration and that they would be able to resolve it quietly. They want to move past this, and a federal investigation and perhaps even some charges would only prolong what is something that they don't want to deal with anymore.
And I will just say that the judge so far ruled it will be in arbitration. However, the attorney in the case said that he may have a separate case because of alleged electronic surveillance, which is obviously a hot button when it comes to a Rupert Murdoch-owned news organization after what we saw in Britain. And the third question I have, and I'll just end on this note, is will Jeff Sessions, as attorney general, allow a further investigation into what is a major Trump ally, Fox News? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Zootopia directors Byron Howard and Rich Moore started out in animation more than 25 years ago.
I was working on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Back then. I started on that show in the 90s, like 1989, actually. Yeah.
But and, Byron, you were Disney.
I started at Disney around 1991 or 1992. My first film was Pocahontas, and I've kind of been on Pocahontas, Mulan, Lilo and Stitch, and I've kind of been at Disney ever since. And so, but it's, yeah, we're both kind of veterans, I suppose you'd say.
Yes, I would say that.
The old guard.
Moore and Howard are the co-directors of Zootopia, which tells the story of big-eyed bunny Judy Hopps, voiced by Jennifer Goodwin. Judy leaves her quiet home on the carrot farm for the booming city, where diverse species coexist in an uneasy peace. Judy is thrilled to be Zootopia's first rabbit cop, but her optimism is dashed when she's assigned to write parking tickets. Then she encounters a smooth-talking con, a fox voiced by Jason Bateman, who tells her she'll never succeed.
Hey, no one tells me what I can or can't be, especially not some jerk who never had the guts to try to be anything more than a popsicle hustler.
All right, look. Everyone comes to Zootopia thinking they can be anything they want. Well, you can't. You can only be what you are. Sly Fox, dumb bunny.
I am not a dumb bunny.
Right. And that's not wet cement. You'll never be a real cop.
You're a cute meter maid, though.
Like all Disney cartoons in recent years, Zootopia was produced using computers. Both Rich Moore and Byron Howard remember when animation changed.
Back in the day, like if you were a high-end hand-drawn animator, you were sort of the superstar.
You were a star.
You were a star.
Big money, mm-hmm. fancy apartments in Paris.
Exactly.
Whole shooting match, yeah.
And it had a lot to do with that particular person's draftsmanship and sort of their artistic stamp, I think, was much more recognizable than when you go into CG, where these artists that we work with are brilliant, but it is much more anonymous because you're taking away that layer of specific kind of aesthetic that they're putting down. Exactly,
yeah.
And it's like it's harder to recognize one person's work from another. So it was interesting mm-hmm. to see that shift, and then the media's attention sort of turned to, okay, how are these things being done? What kind of stories are we telling? But I don't know what your thoughts are, Rich. But
well, I think as far as personalities, the people involved in animation have been exactly the same personality-wise throughout my whole career. Despite the change in medium, that the personality, the characteristics of animators, I don't think that changes. It's like there's a common kind of young, spirited personality that runs through these artists. Mm-hmm. They're actors. Except they're not up in front of the camera. They're performing these scenes through either drawn characters or CG characters that they're manipulating like sculpture, mm-hmm. Or like marionettes. And that love for the craft, like I've never met an animator that's just kind of half-hearted about what he or she is doing. Mm-hmm. They are fully committed to the craft of it. And there is that kind of commonality amongst people that work in animation, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this case of this movie, initially, I read that the Jason Bateman character was the main character.
That's correct, yeah.
And then kind of late in the game, and I'm not sure what that means because animation is not quick.
When is
late in the game?
Late in the game
would be about 3 years before release. It was about a year before release.
Yeah, about a year before release. And you're right, yeah, for many years. This has been in development for about 5 years. It was first pitched about 5 years ago. Initially, weirdly, as a spy movie with all animal characters. And very quickly, we saw this predator and prey relationship. We thought, well, that's really interesting. And then there's this idea of, could we use an animated film to talk about bias and prejudice and stereotype? And we thought, well, we hope we're going to get... We pitched this idea, and unbelievably, we got huge amounts of support from everybody at the company. And so we really dove into that. And so
it goes all the way up the chain of Disney command.
All the way up. And,
absolutely.
It's to Bob Iger.
To Bob. And just the fact that they embraced it and really wanted us to dig in and even supported, like, the first version of this movie was very, very dark. Like, the city in that version was very broken. It was very clearly predator and prey, and there were huge problems and a huge divide between the two groups. And Nick was a predator, and he's a minority in this world, because it's actually true. In the natural world, it's only 10% predators and 90% prey animals. So we took that majority minority and really worked it into the story. But unfortunately, what happened is that you saw this oppressed character, Nick, struggling to make it, and you saw this horrible city that was really kind of crunching down on him, and you hated the city. You wanted him to get out of there. You didn't want him to succeed here or fix anything. You said, just move, get out of there. And so ever we figured that out, like you were saying, like Rich said, like late in the game, we flipped the whole movie and we thought, we really need to make this feel contemporary and talk about subtle bias rather than the in-your-face bias, because the subtle bias is what can be the most dangerous. And the character who needs to tell that story has to be this optimistic young rabbit who thinks that, oh, that's part of my parents' generation. That's their problem. That's not something I have to deal with anymore. And as soon as we did that, the film felt way more contemporary. The city became something you could root for and actually threaten with the villain, the fear-mongering villain, where you'd want them as a pair, Nick and Judy, to bond and relate to each other and succeed in bringing things back to the way they should be.
Was the bunny in the movie before as a character?
Oh, yeah, always.
She was a supporting character. And in this version that Byron was describing, we meet her as kind of a true believer in this kind of divide between predator and prey in mm-hmm. Zootopia. And it really made her unlikable. And it made her seem very naive to the point of stupid, it wasn't the tone that we wanted to tell.
There was one scene that was holding that version in place, and it was a scene that was boarded by a brilliant young woman who is our head of story, Josie Trinidad. We had two heads of story, Josie and Jim Reardon. Josie had boarded this scene. It was called The Taming Party. And in this first version of the movie, predators, because they were scary to the majority prey animals, were forced to wear what were called tame collars. And tame collars were like a dog bark collar that would sort of monitor your behavior. If a predator got overexcited or out of line or angry, it would give them a little shock. And it was actually played for comedy. It was actually very funny.
Sounds
in the first part of the movie.
It's very Orwellian.
You know, it's a very Orwellian idea. But people really dug it. And the idea was that when a child, like a little predator, like a bear or a fox, hit age 5, that was when they started to have to wear them.
Collar ceremony.
So, a bar mitzvah. It was a coming of age ceremony. And so there was this very touching scene that Josie boarded where a father polar bear had to put this collar on his 5-year-old son. And in the guise of this coming of age party, and it was so poignant. There was a moment where the little bear was very excited to get this because this means I'm an adult. This means I'm growing up. And then he gets overexcited and he actually shocks himself. And it was heartbreaking. Yeah. And people saw that and they go, holy smokes, that's so deeply moving and profound that scene. Sometimes we have these scenes that hit people so hard that they'll actually hold versions of the movie in place.
Well, they describe kind of the whole idea, you know.
And yet it wasn't
that one
in the movie.
Did it really, really well. And it came to the point where we had to say, like, okay, we have one great scene that describes the entire milieu. But is this really what our movie's about? Because at the end of the day, the movie's the thing, and telling it well is the thing. So never, you know, on the life of this movie did anyone say, well, just stick with this, even though it's not exactly working. Just go with this.
But is it a sort of a funky feeling where you have this moment where you're like, you know what, we're really going to have to...
Very funky.
It was very funky.
I mean, it's really soul-searching. It's really an artist having to kind of look at what you've toiled over and been passionate about for the past sometimes 3 years and say, like, yeah, is this what I want to say?
We had to stand up in front of a group of 1,000 people who had been working on this film, for some of them for over a year, and building these sets and building characters that now were not going to be applicable and had to be sidelined and thrown away. And they have to have a huge amount of trust in us that we're making the right decision.
Well, so when you tell the 1,000, I mean, because animators have been, in my experience, of chatty people, do they sort of know already?
I think they did. You know, some people loved individual scenes, but they knew that as a whole, it was not coming together. Yeah, I think the animators, they can tell. They're artists, you know, and artists have a deep emotional connection to their work. It's like a living thing. Once you kind of put the main points on the graph into the thing and it knows what it is, there's a weird symbiotic or emotional connection I think the filmmakers have with the piece, you know.
And they know, yeah.
And they know.
Do Bob Iger and Alan Horn actually cry after the screening, not because of the sad scene with the baby bear, but because the dollars are flowing?
Well, you know, that they've always been great. And, you know, I have never seen any other studio be willing to completely throw out a version of a film to reinvent itself. But there's this dedication to never putting out a film that's just of mediocre quality, especially with something like this, where we were trying to be so careful with what we were saying.
The brand is critically important,
totally.
Obviously. You don't want to be the one who screws up.
Disney animated films have a profound effect on generations of people. So we were in a very unique position to be able to do something positive and proactive if we got the nuance of the message right.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Coming up after a short break, Zootopia directors Byron Howard and Rich Moore tell us about the real-life events that influenced them to change Zootopia's plot, even though they were well into production. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to directors and animators Rich Moore and Byron Howard about Zootopia, a contender for Best Animated Picture at this year's Academy Awards. The heroine of the film is Judy Hopps, who confronts prejudice as the first bunny cop in Zootopia history. Her boss, an African buffalo voiced by Idris Elba, finally gives her a shot at working a major case, along with her new partner, a fox and one-time con artist.
We have reports of a street racer tearing up Savannah Central. Find him. Shut him down.
So are all rabbits bad drivers, or is it just you?
Oops, sorry.
Sly bunny.
Dumb fox.
Initially, Nick the Fox was the main character in Zootopia. The decision to focus on Judy the Bunny came when production was well underway. Going back to the virtual drawing board meant the Zootopia directors had to break some difficult news, not only to the animators, but also, as Byron Howard explains, to the voice actors.
Jennifer and Jason had been with us for about a year, I think.
So did they have to re-record and, I guess, renegotiate a deal, extend their deal? And
I don't think we had to. I think the deal was just for the movie in general. But, I think they knew at the core that the movie is
about. They could tell, too.
Yeah, they could tell, too. When we flipped it, actually, Jason got a lot, his part got a lot funnier because now here's this guy, this fox, who was having to deal with this kind of naive but very optimistically pushy rabbit. And their chemistry got better. It felt more natural for both of them.
But they're not in the same room at the same time.
They are. As much as we can.
As often as we can get them together. Yeah. We love to record them together. You know, I think if you're making a movie that is advertised like, you know, it's Jason Bateman and Jenny Goodwin, the audience wants to feel that chemistry, you know, between the two of them.
It works.
Clearly.
When you conceived the movie, so what year are we in?
This is like 2010, or like I had just finished Tangled with Nathan Greno. He was the guy I directed Tangled with.
I'm moving toward this inevitable question because, you know, at the time, those were innocent times. I don't know if you were thinking.
Back in the innocence of 2010.
Yes. So were you thinking, was it Black Lives Matter? Was there any spark? Were you thinking about immigrants? Was there any particular group that inspired you to think about this persecution of the minority?
I think it was just personally. We were in production of the movie when the crisis in Ferguson began. And it really, really hit home that what we were working on thematically in a movie, an animated film about talking animals, it was happening in our real world, in our country. And suddenly it went from a theoretical observation of the world around us into like, no, this is real. And to me, that's when the whole thing just kind of crystallized. It made it so much easier to tell this story.
And I think you're right in that as we were talking about bias and discrimination, the things we were seeing in the news and socially, it's not the same people as we're talking about today. It was different groups. And sometimes, it would go away and it would seem like, hey, things are getting better. But I think that's one of the things that the movie really does talk about is that Judy in the movie has this sort of confidence that things have calmed down, things have gotten better. But it just takes the one little incident to tip things back into these primal, fearful behaviors that we're so having to work so hard to get past. And it's human nature. We learn this about animals too. Humans are animals. We want to protect ourselves. We want to feel safe. So when fear comes up, you're playing on primal instincts. And so it's the folks who are taking advantage of that really kind of worked us up when we were working on this movie. It's like, why do we have to do that? Why can't we cooperate? Why can't we care for one another? Why can't compassion rule our society instead of fear? And that's, I think it's why we cared so deeply about what we were doing and why we were willing to throw it out, like when it wasn't saying what we wanted it to.
Well, and it's established in the film early on that even though she may not be, she sees it happening even before the big hysteria kicks in, still there.
Yeah. Right.
So, and then you guys now become labeled this movie against Trump, which of course is not technically possible. Does Disney get nervous? They don't want to alienate anybody and think that they're making a movie against Trump.
No, you know, I think we really try to make movies for everybody. I do think there is a great sense of inclusion and open-mindedness at Disney that I've always admired. I've been very proud of working here for a long time. Back in the 90s, I was very proud of the fact that I worked at one of the first companies that offered
benefits
for same-sex partners. Yeah. And my husband and I have been together for almost 30 years. And so to me, that was...
That's nice.
Here's this corporate giant, this entertainment giant that cares about people I love. And I feel like at Disney, we're sort of caretakers for this ideal of what this company is for the time that we're here. You know, during our career, it's up to us to keep this company open and moving forward and forward thinking and benefiting as many possible people as
well. Also, I'm going to ask that they ask you guys when you've done a gazillion interviews. Mm-hmm. I forgot to say something earlier. Mm-hmm. Just congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You're getting a lot of awards.
You,
you're nominated for Oscars. I'm like, let me do that now. But did they give you media training, advice, instruction? Don't take a stand. Don't push the Trump narrative or like try to sidestep it. I'm just putting you guys on the spot.
I'm not really. When we go out, we talk from the heart about the movie, you know, and to me, it's like, that's the important thing. And if it flies in the face of what his administration is about, then so be it, you know, but we can only make what's in our hearts, you know, and we believe in these things. And we think that the values that are passed on in our films are important, you know, and
you're animators and artists, right? You're not here to serve a corporate agenda except for the fact that you work for a gigantic media company.
Right, which is really, really weird, you know. But the one thing about artists and animators and storytellers is that the moment we're being objectified, you know, of like, well, how does this fit into the great corporate, you know, it's just the flower closes, you know, the muse disappears. And I think that that's what's great about this company is they know that we're treated like artists. Like, I've worked at many, many different studios in my career, you know, some really, really good ones and some not so great, you know. But this one really respects the filmmakers as the artists that they are and encourages that very, very openness, because we would have no platform to operate from if we didn't feel that we were trusted by our colleagues, you know, and that it's safe to kind of open up and speak what's inside of us.
I think we're very careful about what we're saying and who we're saying it to and the way we're presenting to. Because just as an example, a couple of days ago, we were down at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, and they do this great program where they send out, they gather 31 schools. So we had about 4,400 students, like fifth and sixth graders coming there, and they watched Zootopia like in two groups. And they did these collages about what they took away from the movie and the sort of the social messages in the movie. And to know that something you're making, a piece of art or entertainment, if you have a message or if you have something you're trying to put across, those kids, everyone is going to absorb what you're saying. You know, they're going to feel about it one way or the other. But to think about just for those two groups, 4,500 destinies, like those kids are going to be adults in 10 years and they're going to make decisions and they're going to teach their own children and their contemporaries about their own beliefs. And so I think that's why we spend so long nuancing these movies, especially when we're talking about something so tricky. And it's very heartwarming to see, for us to see that kind of response. The awards are great. Don't get me wrong. Well, love awards. Hooray.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But he's holding three of them right now.
He is right here in the studio.
They're so
cradling them.
They're so shiny. But that's a wonderful feeling.
So screening at the White House.
That would be awesome.
That would have been so good, you know.
It's not like, too late. They just got to Finding Dory, which came
Dory.
Out, I forget what year.
I love Dory, you know, and I love Andrew Stanton. You know, he's one of my best friends, but man, couldn't we get Zootopia in there? You know, I think they could use a screening of it right now. You know, it's finding the parents and everything. That's good, you know. But I think the president could use a couple screenings.
Rich Moore and Byron Howard are the directors of the Oscar-nominated film Zootopia. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was great.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.